Melanie O'Brien. I'm the director and curator here at ArtSpeak. I know most of you. I'm very pleased to introduce today's speaker. Today is the last installation, or installment, I should say, of our Speakeasy series, which started in January. And Speakeasy is something that I've organized with Jacqueline Turner, who's on the board here at ArtSpeak, and Aaron Peck. That really is a way of investigating the relationship between contemporary art and writing. So we've had a series of six, today's the sixth speaker in the series, starting with Charles Bernstein, and we brought together people like Kate Eckhorn and Kyle Mallett, James Pilger and Michael Turner. So it's been a very successful series. I just wanted to thank Jacqueline at the outset for that. But basically, the series was to really ask the question of how visual art and writing as a practice intersect and how they inform one another. So today, the last speaker will be Emil Alphalé, and the title of his talk is Forms of Commentary. He'll be reading selections from recent and older work, including his new novel, Islanders, which just came out from City Lights, and Scrap Metal. And he will also discuss his experiences within the critical vacuum, exploring how different forms emerge and comment on each other. So Emil is a poet, translator, critic, scholar, and activist. He teaches in the Department of Classical and Middle Eastern and Asian Languages and Cultures at Queen's College and is a member of the Faculties of American Studies, Comparative Literature, English, and Medieval Studies at the CUNY Graduate Center. It's a mouthful. Where he's also deputy chair of the PhD program in English. He's the author of Islanders, as I mentioned, a novel, and Scrap Metal, a work in progress, After Jews and Arabs, Remaking Levantine Culture, which is from the University of Minnesota Press, 1993, The Cairo Notebooks, from Singing Horse Press, 1993, and Memories of Our Future, Selected Essays, 1982-1999, from City Lights. A Little History is a book of essays on politics and poetics, and it's due out this year from Beyond Baroque. And Emil has also been involved as an activist on many domestic and international issues. He has been a regular contributor to the Village Voice, and his poetry, prose, reviews, critical articles, and translations have appeared in the New York Times Book Review, The New Yorker, Time Magazine, Al-Aram, The New Republic, Grand Street, Junctions, Sulphur, The Nation, and various other publications.
A long time ago.
In the United States and abroad. So most recently, he is the founder and general editor of Lost and Found, the CUNY Poetics Document Initiative, which we'll talk about today. So welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wow. Thank you very much. It's really great to be here. And thanks to all who helped bring me here. I'm not sure if I'm going to fulfill the mandate here for the series, but I'm going to see where it goes. I'll start by saying that it's very odd to have published this book, Islanders, just now, because the work in it dates from about 1974 to 1976, and it's part of what I want to get to as I go along. But I will start with something visual. The first text that I want to read is from a book called The Cairo Notebooks, which came out in 1993. And The Cairo Notebooks is something that I called a compressed novel. And I guess I called it a compressed novel because it was all I had time to do. And it was most of the material came out of a very intense period of living in Jerusalem from about 1984 to almost the beginning of the Gulf War, 1990. And one of the organizing principles of the text was that there was a horizon line in the book, and that most things had to end at the bottom of the page. And so there was some kind of encoded message in there about the material that I was dealing with, which was in Arabic and Hebrew, and the, you know, the reverse direction of the sentences. And I kind of felt like this horizon line was doing something very important for me. In retrospect, what I've been very fascinated by is seeing that the material in Islanders, which are a series of pieces written, as I said, between about 1974 and 1976, there are five or six of those pieces that I've carried with me and that appear in the Cairo Notebooks and in From the Warring Factions. And I never really thought much about what they were doing there. They just seemed necessary. And retroactively, I'm seeing how much they tell me about what I was trying to bring along with me and how much this new old book is telling me about what happened in between. And part of that has to do with thoughts. I've been thinking a lot about being oddly placed generationally, and that my writing persona has often identified and been close to older people and younger people, and less so people my own age. And that's been a curious place to be as I grow older. And one of the things that I feel I see happening is that I feel a lot of writing that I'm encountering now is, somehow I think of it as being opportunistic and not growing out of changing selves in the way a person might investigate various facets of who they might have been at some moment or some context or some historical point and trying to uncover what that might have been. And part of the process with this was I simply didn't quite understand what this was about, these texts, which were... And in retrospect, after years of actually thinking and teaching about all kinds of aspects of this moment, from kind of what should have been the end of the war in Vietnam but wasn't, about 1969 till about 1975, and living as I was then in a kind of between city and country in a rural situation doing all kinds of odd work, this country had... There was a war against... domestically in the U.S., in talking about the U.S. now, there was a war domestically against the population of the U.S. And the bleakness and the kind of... what I'm characterizing here only became... I lived it, and it wasn't fully comprehensible to me until I really thought about it and tried to figure out what that period was really about. Why were these things... why was this so bleak? And so part of the text that I carried with me in the other books, in Cairo Notebooks and From the Warring Factions, were both kind of memory ballasts, anchors that were very personal, but they were also very, very situated in historical moments that in the texts, Cairo Notebooks and From the Warring Factions, were very obviously historical. There's historical material references to particular political geographical events. From the Warring Factions is dedicated to the town of Srebrenica in Bosnia, where there was a massacre in 1995 of some 7,000 Muslim men and boys. And from the Cairo Notebooks deals a lot with documentary material that I myself was dealing with in the mid 80s, prior to the first Intifada in Palestine, through it and after it, and a lot of it had to do with working with various groups that were exposing land confiscation, torture, particularly of children, etc. And so it was very interesting to me that my history appeared in these very personal anchor pieces that I carried through this time while it was couched in this other history, which I was also part of, but I was in those texts trying to make a differentiation between these histories and trying to see what happened with that. So let me just read, which I haven't read this in years in any public context, the beginning of the Cairo Notebooks. And it has been very strange reading Islanders, which is straight prose. It's very hard to excerpt this. And so it's been a very odd experience trying to figure out how to excerpt it. So I've been doing a lot of cross-cutting and commenting and commentary. But let me read this beginning of the Cairo Notebooks. which, as I said, work was really completed in about 1991. The book came out in 93. And it is, you know, there's a storyline to the photographs, which are my photographs, which also begins at the back and winds its way back around into the front cover. Okay, enough of that. Other glasses. Going from the Grand Canal to Lido and seeing St. Mark's Square for the first time, the words, "I hear Arabia calling," kept running through my head over and over again, like a long-lost amulet I could finally feel touch me. What if either of them, now that it was over, the mother or her daughter, should appear among the faces that passed before him? He remembered the beginning and the end, but had utterly forgotten how they had moved together in between, whether he followed her or she him, whether their unpracticed voices had met and locked or ran on disparate, each cushioned by its own drum. Sometimes at night the curtains swayed in the rooms they weren't in, past the hall whose wood and thickly painted walls had been cared for so well. Once he thought her mother wanted him, or he her, a humid, windless night. She lay there before the open window, the curtains limp. He sat on the edge of her bed at ease but unsure, knowing it wasn't far to get water, but not wanting to leave her side, not wanting ever again to jar the stillness the children had never known after the untimely rites, the discreet violence of a life rearranged. The apprehension of the age was in her face, the gray here and there neither penitent nor defiant, but considered, fully possessed. And if bodily comfort could have been his to give, he would have sunken his face slowly between her legs to make it seem as if it were a dream. But he knew she wasn't quiet, that unleashed the pleasure she would never want to stop, and only by not moving, by fixing the pain above her thick brows and his silence, could he truly provide any. He took his hand and held it to her forehead, letting the tears fall freely. He stroked her hair and gently kissed her eyes. She let her head fall back, her parched lips parted, lost to sleep. More than usual tonight and earlier, but he was so enveloped in her hair that he didn't mind. No sound of steps, no keys, no doors. They would be alone. Did she have men just for the sake of appearance, for that in her that wanted to keep reopening the wound? With him, it was different. She knew he accepted the impossibility of it, and that made it all the more treasured. And because it was impossible, she knew he would be tender, knew he could burrow deep into her farthest recesses. She stirred, then turned and curled, pushing her head between his legs. He pressed her close and held her head defiantly like a precious object. Outside, the night seemed about to burst, but nothing broke in wake of all the rumbling. The water would be filthy until the end of September, and by then this night would be cherished for its mercy by her companions, also cast off and wary of everything except the need to sift the pieces they had been left to reassemble, day by day in each other's loving company. A small claim, perhaps, but one at least in which her daughter had a stake. To eliminate, blindly at first, but with purpose, what she had no choice but to take as the ultimate cruelty of his silence. Words did different work for them, their lack provoking ire in one, tranquility in the other. If only the limits could be abolished, he thought, as if they never were. If only we could love each other voicelessly and without end, and in my silence find your peace. But it didn't get to that. He had never thought it through that far, though they surpassed this in their being together there, in her head between his legs, in his constant hands holding her so tightly. Her daughter's need to first expel him, to gather up her shards, to probe an even deeper layer and reach a place where tools could be recovered whole, made her afraid that such a bond of kinship in the sole company of women would draw them to a pitch that might prove unendurable. To take him fully and finally, as she sensed she needed to, would be one way to circumvent that, for it would be conclusive and wholly unforgivable. Had indifference driven her so far that nothing else was left her but a retribution so concise and willed it could be carried out on no other than her only daughter? Was it so long they had borne each other's fears in their knowing hands, held each other's hair, touched each other's lips? But why deny herself? She knew his silence would be perfect, the dolphin gliding through her waters, and she knew she herself was ready not to erupt, to contain everything he was so prepared to give her selflessly. Either way, they would be together till morning. In the dusty thicket, intrepid liberty traps light. It wasn't winter then, that day in the sunlight, though it rained the day after, and we got caught going in and out of the French bookstore and the stationery shop, the trolleys coming around the curve, kids running home with their school bags strapped to their backs, the vendors hawking their delights, the elders keeping an eye out, the students at the Islamic Museum meticulously tracing the patterns of arabesques and stealing a smile at the tourists, exchanging a few words, the orange glow on the tracks toward dusk, each trolley making that sound of skates being sharpened as it took the turn, the boy without socks swimming in his older brother's shoes, leafing through his schoolwork and practicing his English with us in the magnificent plaza leading up to the Sultan Hassan Mosque, alive with a surge of supplication as people gathered from each avenue to prepare themselves for prayer. So that's a little section from the Cairo Notebooks. I want to read a couple of little quotes at the end of From the Warring Factions. There's a long, rather long, we call it a discussion with Benjamin Hollander, a poet some of you may know, who's in San Francisco, and one of the things I say here is about the Cairo Notebooks. I tried to capture the horror. Okay. Well, I'm talking about a number of things that I was doing on it. Doing book reviews for large circulation newspapers, thinking about language for public debate or political leaflets, doing court transcripts of political prisoners, or translating testimonies of children who had been tortured, all activities that I'd been doing in those years. These were not discrete activities that I could check at the door marked art. I tried to capture the horror, discovery, defiance, and humanity of those years in Jerusalem in the Cairo Notebooks, published in 1993, but mostly completed sometime in 1991. I wanted to get down as much as I could, but the sense remained with me that I was writing a message in a bottle, something to be retrieved, something to be deciphered and interpreted later on. In that book, I not only used documentary materials, I pillaged my own writing, some of it dating back to the 1970s. I felt that it was important not to jettison parts of other older selves, but to bring them along for the ride into this new world I now inhabited and which had become an integral part of me. Paradoxically, by hanging on to those older selves in new contexts, one makes an example out of oneself and removes the work from the trappings of ideology that surround the individual. And this, again, is something that I feel like I articulated then, but have learned more fully through the processing of this, the continual processing of this older material, and seeing what kinds of things it has said about both the forms that my work chose to take or forced itself to take, and what I, more not what I included, but what I excluded, actually. And one of the hinge points, I think there are many, many hinge points, but one of the hinge points for me is a poem that was written, and it appears that is part of this book, Scrap Metal, which in many ways, Scrap Metal is really a commentary on From the Warring Factions. It's almost like the outtakes and the parts of the biography that couldn't be expressed in the context of this book and its accompanying materials. And this was a very important piece for me, both situating myself, historically situating where I thought my writing really emerged from. And it was written, as it becomes evident in the poem itself, it was written in Jerusalem thinking about something that had happened to me as a teenager in Boston, and it's called, and then it's followed by a commentary on the text. It's called Old Poem. Life's rich pageant. Reflect upon life's rich pageant. In it, the poet alludes to death, madness, distance, and loss. Tonight, sitting in the bathroom with the door wide open, looking through the courtyard, and opal and azure glass blown by magicians and alchemists. Tonight, the air fresh against the body, thinking. Suppose it was an odd place to be, trudging through the snow on Charles Street. No, I never did find your place on the other side of the hill where you said the junkies were. I was with my own that night, under the L, waiting at the doorway. Steve kneeling in the middle of the room with a needle. John and someone else shielding the entrance, and that whacked out old hunchback coming down the stairs, ready to have a go at me with a useless Colt 45 cocked in his right hand. Of course, there must have been a cause for the reading we were on our way to. I mean, it must have been for a good cause in those days when a lot of people were getting their heads bashed in or broken open. I've gone a long way myself. It was only later I could give shape to the lie, clothe the colorless in light. Now, this is one of those poems that kind of turn around and hit me in the head, because it's not the way I would have wanted it to end. And it was really commenting on the intensity of that memory and where I was in relation to it. And this is the commentary that follows. That poems emerge from matter, from things and experiences that matter, and that the field might not be particularly friendly, but part of a constant struggle to assert consciousness coming into being, and the constituent facts of that having happened, while everything around you and even within you is only too well prepared to deny any of it ever did. This one took place between two places, 15 or so years apart, sitting in the bathroom with the door open, looking through the courtyard into the window of the little house in Jerusalem, thinking about Boston, knowing certain things but struggling to pinpoint the actual dates to verify where I was. After Kerouac died, before Olson and Steve Jonas, there was a reading, the Charles Street Meeting House, something to do with Moratorium Day, so it must have been 1969, the huge demonstration on the Commons and then the march over the bridge into Cambridge. Denise Levertov, Anne Sexton, John Wieners, Ron Lowenson. I even have the pictures I took of them. Was Sam Cornish there? Garrett Lansing? I was supposed to meet my mother at the reading, but met John Wieners first, and we went to Steve Jonas's place under the tracks by the Charles Street Jail, maybe to pick someone else up. And the other part, of going to look for a friend from high school who'd run away from home and lived on the far side of the hill. Maybe a couple of years later, in the direction of where Scully Square used to be, and that gets mixed in with going to see Ginny McGrath in the hospital, seeing her roll by me with that bright look, straight black hair, very thick wireless rimmed glasses, clearly saying goodbye. A disease? Was it kidneys, the liver? And walking out of there, down South Huntington, away from Mission Hill, back towards the fire station in the village, gone forever, without a trace, disappearing into this thing called America, a little less than three decades before the turn of the century. What's that? Now, this is a transition point at which it's hard to figure out where to go. And I could go in a number of different directions. I think what I will do is read talk a little bit about the relationship of From the Warring Factions, Scrap Metal, and before I get to Islanders, and start with an odd bit of what ended up being praise that came from the wrong direction. In 2005, there's an organization in the U.S. called Campus Watch, which some of you may be familiar with or have heard of. It's a what one would term a neocon organ that monitors activities having to do with the Middle East in academia and cultural, etc. And I've been the recipient of three different articles. The last one, which was called "Poetry, Terror, and Political Narcissism," and very quick. I mean, besides being you know, libelous and slanderous. It didn't take me long to actually realize that it was the best validation of my work that anybody had written, because it came curiously at a point where I was much less involved with specifically Middle Eastern-based or ex-Yugoslav-based things, and more involved in U.S. Venues, and they were the people who were getting paid to monitor these things were very disturbed by the supposed influence that I was wielding in these venues, and it was very interesting to me to. I began then to really think about this business of, as you mentioned, in the, you know, what had been part of my title, feeling myself to be very much in a critical vacuum where. You know, the validation of my work is coming from an attack, you know, a personal attack on me, is an odd place to be, but very useful. I mean, very useful. And what I found unfortunate about it was the people who were purportedly my allies and writing to defend me shouldn't have been defending me, but should have been celebrating the fact that there is power to cultural expression. There is enormous power to cultural expression, and taking the opportunity to further it. And so I began to think a lot about how my own work has had to react to itself in many cases. And I'll give you a quick example of that. The beginning of From the Warring Factions, which is divided into five books. It's kind of has a somewhat of an epic structure, I guess. The first section is called Old Bridge. And I just want to read the first poem and then a later commentary on it from Scrap Metal. And I think you'll see pretty clearly what's happening in this first poem, what it's asking the reader to do. Miro is in the Museum of Modern Art. I'll exaggerate it so it's completely clear. Miro is in the Museum of Modern Art. Miro is in Sarajevo. A famous playwright is on stage at Symphony Space and over the air on NPR. The announcer calls me twice during a break to find out how to pronounce the name Izeta. Izeta is Miro's wife. They have a dog. It is December 1st, 1993. So two things are happening. One is the accent is telling you who the person is, where the person might be. And the second thing is a riddle. December 1st, 1993 demands the reader to account for themselves on that date and figure out what it might have to do with the text. What was happening in Sarajevo in 1993, somebody may or may not be aware of that. And part of, I think, what I had been doing in my translation work, which I hadn't really thought of talking about much, but part of what I wanted to do with that, particularly the work of the poet Semezdin Mehmedinovic in the book Sarajevo Blues, was I wanted to do work in the context of writers that I know, and I wanted it to challenge them to think about themselves and think about what, you know, where they were during this period, what they were engaging with, and what this, the appearance of this work might do to their thinking, both aesthetically, politically, formally, any way you look at it. And in that sense, I think it had quite an effect. I'm not sure if that can quite be codified in any way, but I know that it had. But what happened, I think, for me with Scrap Metal was I feel like, well, if you didn't get it then, let me try to tell it to you another way. And so, in a piece called Interlude, well, let me start with, I'll read. The book opens, which I think I will also read before I read Islanders, and then we might have some discussion. The book ends with a prologue, which I'll read in a few minutes, and then the second section is called End. I finished From the Warring Factions on August 2nd, 2001, the day General Radislav Krstić was convicted of genocide and sentenced to 46 years by the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague for his role in the massacre of some 7,000 people at Srebrenica. A friend of mine who'd been on the front lines defending Sarajevo figured out that the sentencing amounted to 2.39 days per person. And then this section called Interlude, which refers to that poem that I just read you. Interlude. The afternoon before the event at Symphony Space, I'd been home getting ready and listening to Terry Gross on Fresh Air interviewing Izeta Građević, a friend from Sarajevo, who was a founding member of the Obala Theater. I know all Izeta had in her mind was the letter that Zlatko had brought from her husband Miro in Sarajevo. I sat next to her while she read it, as various well-known literary and cultural figures got on stage and recited almost universally inappropriate texts that they thought had something to do with Bosnia. Gross was having a hard time pronouncing Izeta's name, and during a commercial break, my phone rang. I think it was Gross herself, who I'd never met or spoken to, in somewhat of a panic, demanding how to pronounce Izeta's name. I was completely dumbfounded and said something before putting the receiver back on the hook. Almost as soon as I put it down, it rang again. It was the same person asking the same question again. The moral of the story being that people hadn't learned the accent. Even in a public situation in which it was necessary to know it. Let me do this because I'm in Vancouver. I'll read this now. I'd like to read a section or two from Islanders, and it may be about all you can handle. We'll see. This is a prologue, which begins with a quote. But as you know, there always come a time for someone to get out. I'll just tell you, the prologue is a letter to Jack Spicer. And the quote, but as you know, there always come a time for someone to get out. And I look at the kids over here, the way they are playing and the way they are fighting for themselves. And it tells me one thing. Willie, say goodbye to America. Thank you very much. Farewell speech by Willie Mays, Shea Stadium, 1973. Prologue. Dear Jack, every time I go into a bookstore, I still check under S to see if, by any chance, the Martians, or anyone else for that matter, might have brought in something new from you. I'll never forget the night the collected books arrived. It was at that little shop on Sheridan Square. I could check, but I think it's either a cell phone place now or the entrance to a health club that takes up the whole block. Of course, I already had all the White Rabbit stuff in the various pirated editions, but this was different, with the embossed black, white, and red cover, and Robin's essay that I stayed up most of the night reading. I don't even know if you would have approved of the whole thing. That was in 1975. There's so much I want to tell you, Jack. It's like my whole life can be hinged to that moment, holding the book that night with you already dead 10 years, thinking about the befores and afters, the directions taken and not taken. In 1975, when I was working at Jacques Auto Body in the Mission and Custom Body near Howard, I went to a few of the bars in North Beach that you used to hang out in. Years later, when I went back to San Francisco in the capacity of an officially recognized poet, I got to know an old friend of yours, Fran Herndon, and she showed me the collage of Willie Mays that she had done with you using a clipping from, I think, Sports Illustrated, the Say Hey Kid, after whom I renamed myself Willie one summer in grade school when I got sick and tired of having to go through the agony of correctly pronouncing my name for people and realized I could tell new people I met a new name and no one would be the wiser. So much water under the bridge. The first poem I got published was dedicated to you. It was called Charles River for Jack Spicer and went like this. I walked along the banks, banks I watched from boxcars on the other side in the weeds by Brave Stadium. I watched the empty booth above and behind the plate. At the bottom, in with the dead fish, under the banks, beneath sticks buried in the mud, are all the balls I thought the babe hit. I used to walk the 8 or 10 blocks from home to Braves Stadium and wander around in the abandoned shell of it, watching the Boston and Maine run by right along the river. One time a kid we didn't know got his arm ripped off trying to catch a freighter, and they took him to Mass General and sewed it back on, or so the story went. I remember the sirens and the ambulances, the general alarm and concern across the city, and then the wonder over such a medical miracle. I also remember a kid who was in the hospital with me once when I went in for an operation. He had fallen out of an apple tree and broken his skull. They had to restrain him at night in some kind of straitjacket because he would get out of bed and wander through the ward, moaning and howling like a caged animal. All in all, I guess not much has changed. Of course, that's not exactly true. I mean, the Giants don't play in Candlestick anymore, and the Red Sox have actually won a World Series. What I really mean is that when you spoke in Berkeley on July 14, 1965, about not taking the loyalty oath back in 1950, you said, "The word McCarthy is a nice word to use, but it wasn't just McCarthy. It was the whole thing, the Korean War and everything else." The Korean War. Reminds me of a poem I think you should read. It's called The Long March. North from Busan, trailing nooses of dust, we dumbly followed leaders whose careers hung on victory. The road might have been the Appian Way, except for the starving children lining it. We gave what we could to hold back the grave, but in Busan the dead truck snuffled through frozen dawns, retrieving bones and thin sacks, kids who would never beg again. When we bivouacked near Pyeongtaek, a soldier fished a bent brown stick from a puddle. It was the arm of someone's child. Not far away, the general camps with his press corps. Any victory will be his. For us, there is only the long march to Vietnam. Who knows? Given the way the last century's gone, maybe in retrospect, things have actually been getting better. The poem was written, I think, sometime in the 1960s by a guy named William Childress, a little younger than you, though older now that you're dead. He was born in Oklahoma and grew up in a family of sharecroppers and migrant cotton pickers. He joined the Army in 1951 at the age of 18 and served in Korea as a demolitions expert and secret courier. The poem reminds me a lot of the question that Sister Mary Norbert Cordy asked you that same day in Berkeley after your talk, when the discussion veered towards the political effects of poetry and names like Brecht, Mayakovsky, and Shelley were brought up. When Sister Mary said, "Perhaps you don't consider this poetry, but what about the labor songs of the 30s? You said it was a damn good question, and came back singing Pie in the Sky by Joe Hill. I can't remember how I got a hold of her books, but I do remember that she quoted you, Charles Olson, Robert Duncan, David Meltzer, Lew Welch, the Book of Job, and a bunch of other things in Hymn to the Gentle Sun. She wrote Beginning of Lines as a response to Kenneth Patchen's Journal of Albion Moonlight, a book very few people read anymore. Looking back on it, I'd have to say her poetry was like a secret that I only shared with a few close friends. One recently sent me the first lines of that poem by Sister Mary. The high roads of hesitation, we are all part of the path, borders and paving stones and markers and some to light the many turns. Here at the edge of our journey, we touch anew the strange fences, their hidden gates. We learn the spring with blind fingers, find latches cut close to open, loose, and wide. Beyond, the air will be as sun, gentle with our tears, coming into winter. And how shall we account for this pause? How indeed shall we account for this pause? Now that I've outlived you by 10 years, despite the different times we've inhabited, a lot of what you said back then makes even more sense now. The business of being able not to do something, especially things which are so important to you, are you, takes a tremendous amount of patience. For this, it's just as important to be able to understand your own poetry as someone else's. And most poets I know, including some that I admire, don't read their own poems. I mean, they read them out loud to audiences, but they very seldom read them back to see what the things are that would scare them about them. They just, you know, put them in orphan asylums, Grove Press, and that kind of thing. Just leave them there and get $50 for them and, you know, a baby farm. And finally this, there are bosses in poetry as well as in the industrial empire. There seems to be a lot of talk these days, what with new wars going on, about how poets should write or speak. Various commissars are prescribing and proscribing, some in favor of ambiguity, complexity, and skepticism, and others in favor of some variation of plain speech or direct statement. Like so much of what passes for debate here, a lot of this discussion gets displaced, with people fluctuating wildly from almost obscene diatribe and personal insult to polite gentility. Often, as in my own case, the person or body of work largely responsible for opening up the issues is simply not referred to or only obliquely. Kind of like walking into a room of people you think you know and no one even gestures in your direction, like you're invisible. Given your relationship to ghosts, none of this should surprise you. It does make me wonder, though, whether you're better off dead. Look, there's one last thing that I really can't explain to you. You'll just have to try and figure it out for yourself, wherever you are. Pennant races aren't really pennant races anymore. Although you're almost always on my mind when I'm writing, I'm not sure if I'll address any more letters directly to you. Yours, Willie. Okay, if you have the persistence and tolerance, I'll keep going and read a couple of sections of Islanders. It's been very interesting these last couple of weeks doing these readings because I'm reading these things completely differently. I'm understanding things and I'm finding things and it's been very useful to me. As I said, this is extremely difficult to excerpt. I'll do my best with a couple of sections, and I'll begin just, the book is dedicated to an old friend, Gilbert Sorrentino, and it begins, there's an epithet, a line from an Edward Dorn poem, Geranium, I believe. I know that peace is soon coming and love of common object. The first section is called The Table, and I'll read part of that. Let's try this. Artifacts. His own useless ones, or so it must have seemed to others. Newspaper clippings, matchbooks, pencils, pens with names of businesses on them, ashtrays, ticket stubs, the shoehorn, church keys, automobile leaflets. Even then, as a boy, there were great lengths he would go to in order to demonstrate something. Once, walking with a group of kids on a familiar street, a strange boy stopped and pushed one of his group. He grabbed the strange one, and before he knew it, felt knuckles under an eye that stayed half shut as his head rested on the cool sidewalk. News traveled fast, so she knew about it. The blow hadn't been quite enough to blacken the eye, so the boy made it up with shoe polish that night so she would see him the next day, even though she and everyone else knew it wasn't that bad. When he went in to adjust his disguise, he couldn't get the stains off the sink in the boys' room. The knobs on the faucets had springs in them, so the boys wouldn't leave them running and flood the sink, leave them on till the water topped and flowed down over the floors, running out the door and filling the halls till the spigots rusted and the water froze and they could skate away from their assigned rooms, slide down the stairs and escape into the cold, fresh air. Consumed as he was by her, she never knew it, never knew of his elaborate schemes, each move and thought a signal towards some sort of consummation, the brushing of their hands, his hand on her hair or resting on her shoulder, even if only for an instant. He never knew whom she loved or if she had loved anyone, whether anyone other than in their dreams had plunged toward her soft stomach, been consumed by her strong thighs, or laid their head in her long, round breasts. He had checked for flats that night and swore to her that he heard the tires bump as he pulled over on a curb at the top of the hill by the ocean in the soft, grassy bank under the bright moon. He walked slowly, checking each tire, bending to the road to inspect the wide, white sidewalls, the light of the moon against the baby silver caps, a wave etched in, painted red, in which the outline of a ship crested. Above that, the word Plymouth in small, square letters. She laughed out the window as he got up from the grass and put his foot on the running board to reach in for her, the old blue car looking almost new in the moonlight reflecting off the ocean below. After that summer, it sat in an empty field for many years. Once he had gone to look at it, weeds had sprouted through the rotted floor and the little paint left was dull. Stuffing from the seats hung out of the rips and holes the sun and rain had made. Spiders inhabited the spaces between the rear window and the back of the seat. Only one tire had any air left in it, and two of the windows were broken. The door is still clicked shut tight, but the right one made the rear quarter panel flap since the support bolts had rusted off. The silver on the mirrors had peeled and spots of black shone through. Brittle leaves lay thick on the floor like on the path through the woods that led back to the old house, now boarded up since the new people had made it an early season. These mornings when he got up, he wondered whether there would ever be other times like those they had together, or whether he would even see her sooner in the distant future. The plan he continued formulating daily of how to approach her, what to say. One plan if he saw her from a distance, another if they met unexpectedly. The tedium of his acts gained steadily on him and formed a great weight he carried with him. And though through the screen each morning the birds sang to him and him alone, and the air brought him the taste of the sea to gently lift him out of his dreams and into his shoes, he still walked slowly and without apparent direction. Each morning he stumbled around the small rooms of the shack, arranging things he had set in disorder the night before. Books and papers lay scattered in the bedroom, clothes thrown at random, the dishes still on the table, and sometimes the radio still on. The cool air on their backs and their walk in the coarse, chilled sand seemed vague to him now, a moment in a movie he might have seen as a child. He referred again and again to what seemed his last surviving hold, a vast catalog of references that she could never know the order of. Randomly, beginning at the end of the beach, working her way to the other end, she wanted to count the rocks jutting out of the water, or ride a horse down the beach. A way to say what they wanted, whether in cars or houses, a return to something they thought they might have had, her green eyes and cheeks full of sweet blood the day they had picked apples, the train rumbling by as they kept driving further north, one looking out one window, another out the other. "Sometimes I wake up crying," she said, water hitting the windshield. Dead leaves piled by the porch of a passing house, the shape known, some old form against the corner of the street, her return in the November sun. Return, as if such a word could even be considered, something so vague as misplaced memory, none ever offered, none saved. Let's see if I can find one more bit here. It's difficult to choose. Well, this is a piece that takes about 7 or 8 minutes to read. So,
I used to tell our bridge readings around here.
Good. Oh, I could go on. I'll go on. This is a piece called Blue Gray. You read the whole thing. Let's start it. See what we get. Blue Gray. That might be. Well, let me read. Let me read this section, and then we'll see. This is very much a turning point in this piece, in this book. Okay, a little preface. Here we go. Always some fish story. Sorry, always some story, some fish story. Some sort bigger than anybody had ever seen, some coast, down south. That winter, the trip down past the Keys, the man lost his hand to the winch. Who'd forget it? The way slack drew and fingers flew through the rolling cable and landed on deck. He remembered them in thick fog, always lined up on the dock with slime caked on their boots, their long red and black caps, thick wool shirts, maroon checked with aquamarine, deepest black. He ran back and forth with buckets for the bait fish or the tin tubs filled with hooks and line that the old man would hook from the anchor on the back of the truck to a spike on the bulkhead and stretch the length of the parking lot. Father yelled orders from the cab. Son ran frantic, fastened the hooks, did the limbo, his back bent to look. If the line snapped, his head would roll. He'd make up for all his father's errors. Captain Allen, Morgan Allen. He displayed the boy at the gas station, his latest cuts and bruises, the newest plank on the old boat the harbor master seldom let in the harbor. A Navy launch he towed past the bank towers with a beaten, borrowed tug. He beached it in the pond beside some trees, single-handedly broke it up, then put it back together again. No sooner than his new boy could walk, he was put to use. The other brothers had abandoned him, worked on the mainland to support their mother, his daughter, their sister, a paltry excuse. The new boy was his, all his, and he kept him close whenever he could. Men from the other side by the creek gathered to watch the boy as he hung off a rope tied to the flying bridge. In and out of the water he went with a hammer in his hand, nails in his mouth, and a plank of wood between his feet. Each time he went down, the hammer got heavier, the nails harder not to spit or swallow, and the plank longer, tougher to move. He got so he could hold the plank with his feet, bend forward, rolled into a semicircle, and hammer it in. If he slipped, he fell the length of the slack. The rope grabbed, stopped, and he bounced in midair from the tension. Line gripped under his crotch and shoulders, the pain shooting through his stomach to his neck and throat. When his father wasn't looking, the boy hung there, staring dumb at the rotten green of the hull, trying to figure out how many coats the wreck had on it and how long each new plank would last. The boy scurried around the wharves between the stands set up for dry dock like a pack rat, kicking and nudging every board he passed. If nothing loose or good enough was on the wharves, he'd go to the dump, running down the hill through the burning garbage between the sick old elms armed with bottles to throw at the gulls. He rummaged around until he stacked the pile and found stuff to make a stand for the planks. Milk crates, boxes, rocks. Set apart a few feet, he'd stack the planks across them, then dip his arms under like a forklift. Out of the dirt to the main road that led to the dock, he walked the 3 miles to the water. Saw deer as they cut swift through the brush and dead leaves and listened as they smoothly disappeared. By the time the boy was harnessed and dropped from the flying bridge, the men from the creek spotted him and came over. They sat, leaned on the spiles, cheered, laughed, and made bets. The dog was trained to dive off the pier and wrestle the wood away from the boy as he tried to nail it in. Even the father watched with amusement as the dog wrestled the boy over the wood. The dog got better and better and soon knew how to remain underwater long enough to nip at the boy's ankle or thigh. One day the dog took a chunk out of the boy's calf. The men slapped and jostled each other as the boy yelped with hurt. When the dog surfaced, the boy hit it over the head with his hammer, grabbed its ear, held its head underwater till he felt its weight stop, release, and the dog sink to the bottom of the harbor. When someone made a motion toward the boy aimed his hammer at the man's head and said if he took another step, he'd do the same to him as he'd done to the dog. They yelled and swore, but soon the men dispersed and went back to the other side. Another day on deck, as they worked at baiting tubs, the boy asked about the reindeer. Other boys, when they gazed from shore through the signal lights on bank towers, thought the signal lights on bank towers looked like reindeer. At night, over black water, reindeer that flashed red and white. In the sun, the outline of a tail, back and head clear, up front, a bright red nose. The father spat at the deck, glared at the boy, kicked tubs in disgust, paced, slapped at the winch handle, and muttered. He told him not to go home, to go right from the fort to the boat and wait in the cabin till he got there. The boy spent the rest of the afternoon in the fort, in his room, at his table. He stared at his pictures, smoked cigarettes, and listened to what the water did to the loose wood underneath. Before the sun went down, he walked back to the boat and climbed in the cabin. Through holes in the old wainscoting, he could see through the hull. He heard boats as they docked or left the harbor. Ropes tugged, slack tightened, the boat bobbed with the tide and the spiles creaked. Steps came back and forth, but no body tipped the deck towards the dock with its entering weight. He heard a thud. New weight and heavy steps on deck. As he went toward the door, there was a knock of tin. Some tubs tumbled. Something dragged and dropped near the door. He pushed at it. Soon the old man's cracked voice sang. A cough, a sputter. The motor turned over and sparked, chugging till it caught, and water started to gurgle through the rotten exhaust the boy repaired periodically. It reared, rolled, and went ahead. The motor revved, then slacked off as the captain navigated the harbor. It died once through the current between the twin jetties, caught till it got loud again and remained that way. He bent his ear to the door to catch a word and heard tubs move, the winch winding. Every now and then, wisps of light filtered through the cracks, runner lights from other boats. Those stopped. He guessed they were out to sea and that his father had shut their own runners off. The man stumbled to the cabin door, bent to the box he had dragged there, and pulled it away. He turned, dragging his feet after him. The door swung open and swayed as if no one had opened it. By the time the boy got used to the little light that came through and stepped toward it, the man was back in the wheelhouse. The tower's red-white signals flashed dead ahead. They stayed straight at them. The boy stood on the steps to the wheelhouse and watched the red-white blink on his father's worn-out eyes and cracked skin. Once red, twice white, twice red, once white. He popped it in reverse before they would have gone through, let the motor idle, pushed the boy out of the way, went to the rail and grabbed for a piece of frame. The glare of the light through the thick glass fisheye covers hurt the boy's eyes. The man took the boy by the neck, drew him to his mouth, and drawled through the thick liquor breath he'd got from the booze he spent the afternoon drinking. You want to know the bank? You want to see fucking reindeer? I'll show you reindeer. With one powerful thrust, the man picked the boy up, hoisted him over the railing, and deposited him on the tiny square platform one of the pontoons made. The boy made no sign, looked down, saw where his feet were, clutched the frame, and watched his father's mad face stare back. Once red, twice white, twice red, once white. The figure turned from the rail and went back to the wheelhouse. The motor's pitch rose. The boy tried to scream, but when he opened his mouth, no noise came. With the runner still off, the boat slowly faded from the glare of the flashing lights that skimmed across the black water. The noise of the motor disappeared. The only sound left to hide the boy's sobs was the water as it lapped against the pontoons and the bells above him that rang out as the buoys rolled. That's a tough act to follow. At your disposal. Do we do talk?
Sure.
Could you read Jordan's quote again?
Yeah, sure. I know that peace is soon coming in love of common object. And I'm pretty sure it's from a poem called Geranium, which I think is in Hands Up. Mid-60s, So, I don't know. Thoughts, responses, questions? Charles.
I'm certainly in a bit.
It's an auction house, you know. Don't make a move.
Would you talk, just because I'm selfish and interested, a little bit more about your concept of autobiography and the way, I think you mentioned, sort of the way the past, you select from the past to sort of create a present self. Mm-hmm. How you understand that? I think you said something about you felt that people were inserting texts in many cases in readings that had nothing to do with the past. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe explore that for us?
Sure. There's a lot of things. I mean, several things come to mind. One is, during a certain period, which I will not label it, let it remain nameless, of U.S.-American writing particularly, I think there was a very concerted effort to conceal one's origins and biographical information or context. And whether this had to do with, I don't know, a certain kind of, it had to do with a lot of things, I think. And there was a kind of sense of people with biographies are other people. You know, they're ethnic people, or as if everybody isn't. Or they're, you know, people who have biographies and have narratives. And I think I reacted very negatively to this whole thing. But I also wanted to complicate, obviously, this question of a biography, a narrative, a life. And I think that my work in translation had a lot to do with thinking through some of these things, because a lot of the work that I was translating in the terms of so-called experimental writing, or the kinds of writing that, let's say, writers that I might be involved in, a lot of these texts seemed, on the surface, to be very conventional, formally. But I found them extraordinarily difficult to, not to translate, but to transfer into the context that I was trying to transfer them. And it occurred to me that a lot of these texts were dealing with almost a representation of a coming to consciousness. Example of it, not something I translated, but there's a Salvadoran poet, Roque Dalton, who has a poem called Ars Poetica 1974. And the poem goes, poetry, forgive me for having made you understand you're not made of words alone. Poetry, forgive me for having made you understand you're not made of words alone. And in this, I think the date is very crucial, because this would seem to be the date at which he realized this. And it was a marker. And that's, in a sense, that date that I use in that first poem that I read. So I think I was trying to figure out how, because especially in terms of prose, I mean, I think the situation is pretty dire and drastic, and that most prose I pick up just doesn't seem like the writer has read any of these sentences aloud to themselves. They're just kind of tinier kind of prose in what is kind of generally mainstream prose. There seems to be a deep disconnect between poetry and prose on anything outside of a very, very small circle of writers. Nothing like a thing that might have seeped into some of the writers that I'm very close to, for whom I think the prose in Islanders follows is very much a kind of prose that I think stopped being written at a certain point generally. So there's a lot of different factors. I mean, the kinds of things like, in what context is something radical? You know, I mean, a very conventional narrative might be very radical in some contexts. There's all kinds of ways that one can, and that has to do with context, and context is what one brings to a situation, where one situates oneself in it. So I was playing with all of these things in terms of my own self, and obviously as one starts to get a little bit older and more, you know, you start to realize that there is a time that you embody that particularly younger people might not have any idea about. And it's very important to figure out ways to transmit it that are not didactic, but that are not kind of like, oh, every, you know, the good old days kind of thing, but that are exciting and activating, that will activate people's own memories and biographies. And there's a wonderful quote that I used somewhere in After Jews and Arabs by the great Egyptian filmmaker Yusuf Shaheen, where he talks about the political necessity of memory and of taking those parts of yourself that interacted with the various contexts. So he said, that, you know, as an Egyptian, he said, the American dream part of me needs to be part of my biography, the socialist revolutionary needs to be part of, all of those things need to be taken with me to show, because otherwise you can't show any distance or any movement in a self. So I think part of it also has to do with how one gauges or activates distances between parts of oneself and shows where one has been and gone.
Maybe I can give a metaphor. It seems that there's a person and a persona, and the person and persona are in kind of a dialogue, and I really like the Chilean poet's way of putting that. Mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts?
Well, I'm really curious about how you were juxtaposing some of the earlier stuff or from the other books and then moving into the Islanders. And I mean, I kind of feel a buzz of memory and acquaintances and places and so forth. So I'm just curious about this notion of, and that's why I asked you to repeat the door, objects, that sense of touching objects. I wonder how that particularly that scene where you're sitting in the toilet in Jerusalem, projecting this scene at Charles Street.
Very important, yeah.
In Boston. Is this, are you trying to recover? recuperate? I mean, is it an act of recuperation that this memory is what's going on here?
I don't think so. I mean, in other words, I don't need to even recuperate it. I mean, the click of that Colt 45 is in my head constantly. It's not something forgettable. So it's not kind of recuperating. To me, it's more juxtaposing it, activating it in another time and place, and then seeing. I mean, one of the things that I'm very interested in and constantly trying to do, particularly teaching and also writing, is what happens when you put disparate things on the same table that don't necessarily seem to belong there. What new relationships form? What avenues, what access points become available or possible? So I think that has a lot to do
with it. Well, the voice you use is the voice of your questioning. Mm-hmm. Was it there? Was it you?
Yeah, that's the comment. I mean, that's the kind of post-commentary. Like,
that's why I asked, why it's recuperative.
I think that's more that's more questioning, well, how have I constructed the importance of this memory? In other words, how has this memory assumed another proportion at a different time? You know, where it was something that one just lived, what happens to it is it assumes a different kind of proportion in relation to other things, particularly to me in relation to, and not necessarily recuperative, but in relation to, I mean, the deeper question there is about my friend who I think died, and I really don't know what happened to her. You know, when I mentioned visiting this friend in hospital, and I just don't know, and I have had no way of finding out. And that's, you know, unfortunately seems to be a kind of typical thing in our transient world, that this kind of thing happens. And so there's that as well. So that question then becomes, you know, did I dream that? I mean, I don't think I did. I remember her look very precisely. I remember leaving the So it calls into question, you know, it doesn't call into question the positing that fact or that memory, but how it, you know, where, what has become of it, you know, what has become of it? Has it assumed greater proportion? Has it assumed? I mean, there was a Charles Olson centenary event in Worcester, Mass, just a week or so before I came to the West Coast, and I was working with a friend of mine on a presentation. It was a whole group of people doing things related to the body, and I was thinking about this business of you know, what is the proportion of memory? I mean, do memories assume greater space when you have less of them? Is it, you know, as you're younger, or do they? I mean, what is the proportion of that kind of thing? Do particular things assume more space? As you know, I'm not articulating this well, but I had thought through it quite well, you know, quite well, I think, and read through a lot of things and thought about that. You know, what space does it occupy? I think is also a question. Yeah.
There seems to be a lot of motion, a lot of movement. Are you using long sentences? That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
It's what gets caught up in the sentence that generates the narrative.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's very... I guess that's what I meant by... when I began with this visual thing here, I mean, I think so much of my work is really just reliant on rhythm and on rhythms of pacing. And I mean, that last piece that I read, dramatically so... And the mix of short and long and stretching and where something might particularly stop, you know, where one would stop and what the drama of that stopping is, and that's true as well in not in as much in the poetry that I read you, but there's other things that I could easily, you know, demonstrate that with. But yeah, very important, central thing, rhythm. I might actually, just as a coda, let me read two things and then we can relax. I thought of these particularly because I had the pleasure of spending a couple of days when I was in San Francisco with Diane De Prima, and have been urging her and thinking about. She has so much material that is. Lectures on Shelley, lectures on John Dee, lectures on Paracelsus, all kinds of amazing things. And we read together, and I read two of these poems, which everything except book one of From the Warring Factions is composed of found language. And the last poems. And it's very much the opposite of a collage or a cut-up kind of technique. It's much more like a painter who has a palette, and those are the, you know, combinations of colors that are being used. But the last five poems, I'm going to read two of them, that in book three, which really does just uses a lot of material immediately descriptive of Srebrenica, I end with language that I used from that I found in Shelley's Revolt of Islam. And I was kind of taken towards that poem just because it was the only poem I could think of in any canonical sense in English that had the word Islam in it so prominently. And I thought, in addition to Shelley's ideas about tyranny and other things, that it would be very useful if on a cellular level, if Shelley's words were brought to this situation. So read two of these and end with that. Morning broke like iron shapes which fled in wonder, shadows which pursued Morning broke like iron shapes which fled in wonder, shadows which pursued a sound like thunder, the roots of the sea out of a burning oven, columns and shapes like statues, and the state of kingless thrones, that wild bird, a poisoned robe, the eagle in the air, as if some living thing in the fountains of my life, like sweet reality, when the rain of winter of questioning lingers, a source appears like a green home, and sitting there alone, I was no longer mad, the blood stood still, delusion in my memory, and all its shapes possessed by thoughts which could not fade. My prison was the earth made desolate. Grief was meaningless. I found a woman wandering the streets. As she heard my steps, she leapt on me and glued her burning lips to mine. I took the food she offered so I might be free of hope. We passed without a word, one shape of many names, the shade, the pattern, like a mine I rifled through and through to track the steps of freedom, its secrets, a subtler language, from which I drew the power to make immortal the disastrous frame of all I read of sorrow. Suddenly, like shapes of living stone, clothed in the light of dreams, I tore the veil, the shrouds which wrap the world, the frost of death, the flood of tyranny, a paradise of flowers, within which the poor heart loves to keep the earnings of its toil, a common home, stains of inevitable crime, pride built upon oblivion to rule the ages that survive our remains, violence and wrong, an unreturning stream, the grief of many graves, snow and rain on lifeless things. This is not faith or law, opinion more frail, or life poison in its wells that delights in ruin, as endless armies wind in sad procession. The earth springs like an eagle, even as the winds of autumn scatter gold in the dying flame. We learn to steep the bread of slavery in tears of woe. These faded eyes have survived a ruin wide and deep, which can no longer borrow from chance or change what will come within the homeless future, that gold should lose its power and thrones their glory, that love which none may bind be free to fill the world like light, whose will has power when all beside is gone, faint accents far and lost to sense of outward things, some word which none here can gather, Yet the world has seen a type of peace, some sweet and moving scene returning to feed on us as worms devour those years, come and gone like the ship which bears me in this, the winter of the world. We have copies of Islanders, and we also have some copies, and more can be gotten of... I just want to say something briefly about this project that I began with my graduate students at the CUNY Graduate Center. I have a lot of students who are doing archival work in contemporary materials, and at a certain point, we just decided to start publishing these ourselves, and we've started this project, which is burgeoning into something very exciting. And the first series features, I will let you know, selections from the collected letters of Amiri Baraka and Edward Dorn. These are 1959 to 1960. A two-volume thing, The Correspondence of Kenneth Koch and Frank O'Hara, 1955-1956. A text by Muriel Rukeyser called Darwin and the Writers, which had been sent into the Nation and rejected and was sitting in her archive in the Bird Room in New York. Selections from Philip Whalen's journals from early times, 57, and then from 77, also two volumes. And the 1963 Vancouver Poetry Conference, Robert Creeley's Context of Poetry, with Daphne Marlatt's journal entries. And so these are here, and we have a few sets, and we're basically doing them by subscription and contribution, and is the idea. So any, you know, we have some forms and we have some sets. So you know, I'm happy to look at them, and some of you are going to be getting them in the mail, or may have already gotten them in the mail, because part of the subscription idea was I was just going to send them to a whole bunch of people that I thought needed to get them, and then. So much the better if they subscribe. I mean, it's kind of the floating bear principle. Just send it out and see who adheres to the program. So we have those, and thank you very much.
Thank you.